Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the September 8th, 2012 edition of Space Talk. Back with you live on the air, right here on WMMB. Well, this is the week that the Lord hath made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. NFL football is back. Kickoff Sunday is tomorrow. My Minnesota Vikings play your Jacksonville Jaguars in a game you can listen to right here on WMMB. And while this has nothing to do with our space program, it's got me pumped up and looking forward to digging into those bratwursts and sauerkraut. Because after all, it doesn't matter who wins or loses, so long as the food is served hot and the drinks are served cold. Well, it's great to have you join us today on Space Talk for our first live show back in our original time slot of Saturdays at 2 p.m. For those of you who have followed us into this time change, thanks for following us to Saturday. For those of us, for you who are finding us for the first time, welcome. You are listening to a weekly one-hour program about our nation's space program, in which no space-related topic is off-limits. If it has something to do with spaceflight, we will discuss it right here today and in the future on Space Talk. You are always welcome to join us on the program with your questions or comments about space. You can give us a call at 321-768-1240. Or if you're a little shy with the idea of being live on the air, we invite you to contact us online. Just send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. And we'll see it on the screen here in the studio, and we'd love to have your input. Well, I hope you enjoyed our Best Of edition of Space Talk last week, in which we replayed most of our July 1st program, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy Space Center. I took the weekend off, not only because it was Labor Day, but because I have spent the past 2 weeks visiting NASA's aeronautical field centers in California, Ohio, and Virginia, to learn more about the important research our space agency is doing in that area. And so that becomes the topic for today's installment of my more or less weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. Well, we should never forget that the first A in NASA stands for aeronautics, and the research into all things aviation is something NASA and its predecessor organization, the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, the NACA, not NACA, by the way, but the NACA, get it right, has been doing for nearly 100 years. As I said, I just spent the past 2 weeks visiting NASA's field centers in California, Ohio, and Virginia. Got a firsthand taste of just some of the things each of these centers are working on. My first stop was the Dryden Flight Research Center at Edwards Air Force Base in California, where I talked with folks who are working on making it possible for supersonic airliners of the future to fly overhead in such a way that you don't hear a sonic boom, as well as some folks who are among those at NASA who are coordinating the agency's role in determining how best to operate civilian remotely piloted vehicles within our national airspace system. I then dropped in at the Ames Research Center just south of San Francisco and reviewed some of the ways NASA is working with the FAA to help get airline passengers from their departure gate at the airport to their arrival gate at the next airport more efficiently, and in ways that will save the airlines money and fuel costs, which, of course, could help reduce ticket prices or, well, at least help ticket prices from rising as quickly as otherwise. I traveled on to Ohio to the Glenn Research Center in Cleveland and learned there of NASA's ongoing efforts to examine the use of alternate fuels in jet engines that are more environmentally friendly, as well as work they are doing there to develop new ceramic materials and coatings that will make jet engines lighter and more efficient in the way they operate, also with an eye toward reducing fuel costs. Then I wrapped up my whirlwind tour with a stop at the Langley Research Center near Norfolk, Virginia. Now, Langley is the mother center from which all other NASA centers and our space program in the form of the Space Task Group was born, and where both aviation and space research continues in earnest. At Langley, I saw how NASA is working with Boeing and others on a new way to literally stitch together layers of composite materials, and in doing so, create huge, lightweight, and super strong structures that could be made into flaps or wings or even entire aircraft. Again, if you get the theme here, with the idea of making airplanes safer and more fuel efficient. I even talked with a very engaging and enthusiastic researcher who has a team working on ways to keep the bug guts from insects that smash into the leading edge of a wing from accumulating and disrupting the smooth flow of air over the wing, which, of course, is necessary for generating lift. I think anyone who lives here on the Space Coast and drives on the freeway during love bug season can probably appreciate some of the challenges and potential benefits that are there. Also at Langley, and really at all of NASA's aeronautical centers, I was reminded of the incredible research tools the agency has available to it in the form of its laboratories and test rigs and wind tunnels, especially, of course, the people who do the hard work within budgets that are tight, to say the least. You know, for all the time we spend talking and whining sometimes about how our space program never has enough money, and certainly count me among them as I agree that our national investment in space should be much greater than it is now. At least the space side of NASA in 2012 had close to $18 billion to work with. Now, you might be surprised to learn, perhaps even shocked, that out of all those quote-unquote billions of dollars in NASA's budget, the amount the agency is allowed by the President and Congress to spend on aeronautics research is barely $600 million. That's right, you heard it, $600 million with an M. Think of it this way. NASA Aeronautics is 25% of the agency's acronym, but gets barely 3% of the funding. Now, I've proudly declared many times being a space cadet since I was a young boy growing up in Minnesota, but I also have been a propeller head just as long. In fact, I used to draw pictures of airplanes on all of my homework. I probably put together more models of airplanes than spaceships in my life, and I even took my first flight lesson before I got my driver's license. And, of course, I have an aviation business degree from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Well, for the past four years, as part of the consulting work that I do through my company, Mila Solutions, I have been writing about aeronautics for NASA, and I've come to know these aviation-minded folks at NASA and their work as well, or perhaps even better than my friends on the space side of the house. And I can tell you this. Given the amount of money NASA Aeronautics is allotted each year, these folks are producing for our nation far more bang for the buck than I think anyone realizes or could possibly appreciate. I even dare say that perhaps on a dollar-for-dollar basis, our return on investment in aviation research with NASA is probably orders of magnitude greater than anything we see coming from our space program. Well, you'd think after 100 years of flight, we'd know everything there is to know about aviation, but you'd be wrong. True, our aeronautical technology and aviation system is second to none, but there's still so much more to learn and still so many ways to make all aspects of flying through this planet's atmosphere, that is, this planet's atmosphere, a safer, more efficient, and less costly experience for all of us. Like our space program, NASA's aeronautics research deserves more fiscal attention from our nation's leaders and more awareness and appreciation from the flying public. And that's this week's Orbital Inclinations. Well, look, we're going to take a quick break here. When we return, we'll talk with three local folks here that will be honored this week for their longtime contributions to the space program. Lifetime Achievement Awards given out by the National Space Club Florida Committee presented this Tuesday afternoon. And all three gentlemen are here in the studio waiting to talk to us. Don't miss it. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to participate in the program today. You can also always send us an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. And so great to have you with us on this Saturday afternoon at our original time slot of 2 p.m. as Space Talk has moved in the weekend programming lineup here at WMMB to make room for NFL football on Sundays, which I'm perfectly happy to support, of course. You can tune in tomorrow to hear the Jacksonville Jaguars play, coincidentally enough, my Minnesota Vikings. And I did mention a moment ago that I was recently in Ohio this past week, and before our flight left for Virginia on Wednesday, I had time to run down to the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio, for just a couple of hours, which was a thrill, of course, as the first game of the season was that night. We made it to Virginia and to our hotel just in time to see the Cowboys beat the Giants. But it occurred to me while I was at the Hall of Fame, staring at the bronze bust of legendary Vikings head coach Bud Grant, that perhaps we ought to make bronze busts of the three gentlemen who are with me in the studio today, each of them about to enter our own version of a Florida Space Program Hall of Fame. This Tuesday, the National Space Club Florida Committee will present its annual Lifetime Achievement Awards, an honor that recognizes significant contributions to our space program through a long career of effort that was focused here on the Space Coast, whether at Kennedy Space Center or Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. Past award winners read like a who's who of local space heroes, and as a member of this year's selection committee, I can personally attest to the fact that each of these folks do deserve to be added to the list. I'll let them, each of them, brag about their accomplishments and tell them their life stories, so we'll keep the introduction short. With me are Dr. Addison Bain, Art Edwards, and Terry Greenfeld. Gentlemen, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you, Jim.
How you doing, Jim?
Doing good. All right, hey, great. Addison, let's start with you. We're going to go alphabetical order, left to right, as the ball flies on the radio dial. How did that phrase go? Used to go? Addison, you are like, as we read everything, you are like Dr. Hydrogen. You are Mr. Propellants, man. You part of Von Braun's team originally at ABMA back in Huntsville. Propellants guy. Talk about your background and how you got here and why.
I'd say my interest started back when I was a young boy during World War II and became very fascinated with the V-2 rocket.
Really?
Yeah. So I had to build one myself.
Oh, yeah.
But, of course, I didn't have liquid propellants.
Okay.
So I took a whole bunch of fireworks and cut them all apart and got all the nitrates and potassiums and all that out of there. And put that in the tube, and the V-2 looked just like the V-2, the old black and white,
really?
You know, characteristic camouflage colors there. You know,
the National Association of Rocketry cringes at the thought of you mixing your own propellant, right?
Yeah. Well, all I did is wind up burning holes in my dad's immaculate lawn. So.
So then you said engineering is for you, and you focused on propellants as a career path?
I started off in engineering, and then I got drafted into the Army.
Okay.
And I was in Fort Ord, California. And I was, after my basic training, I was called in. The captain called me in for my assignment. And he says, well, Mr. Bain, or Private Bain, said, since you got a perfect score on all your tests out here, we're going to have to take 2 years from your life. You're going to give us 2 years. Mm-hmm. What would you like to do in
like
the Army?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I want something to do with rockets.
Okay.
Well, next thing I knew, I was in Huntsville at Redstone Arsenal working for Von Braun as a physicist in the guidance and control lab.
And that's amazing to me because at that time, of course, rockets and all that is the stuff of science fiction. There's not a lot being written, not a lot of publicity about it, and you sort of caught the magic of that real early.
Well, we had to create the equations and that type of thing, and that was very interesting, I thought.
I got to ask you real quick, of course, Von Braun, legend, you know, controversial figure to some. Did you get a chance to meet him, talk with him, work with him?
My first day there, I did, yes.
Yeah, what was that like?
I met him and General Medeiros.
How did he? Oh, General Medeiros, too.
Yeah.
Another great legend.
Oh, yeah.
And,
he saw me. I was coming up the headquarters building at 4488 there at the Marshall.
What was your first impression?
Yeah, I was impressed. And he saw I was carrying my manila folder, so he knew I was checking in the personnel.
Sure.
He said, what's your MOS? And I said, physicist. He says, well, you're going to wind up in the guidance control lab. And that's exactly what happened.
and real quick, through the years, I mean, again, you've been known for your hydrogen work and your propulsion work. You know, just something that caught on to you about that little molecule.
Yeah, well, after the Army, I got interested with Brown Engineering. I got into propellants, designing propellant systems for the Kate. And then I came down and joined NASA in January 65 and wound up being in the propellants branch. And that's where my favorite topic was hydrogen, of course.
Right.
So aside from the NASA thing, then I did a lot of international work on hydrogen technologies and helped formulate a lot of the associations and societies on hydrogen.
Okay.
And so that just kept on going. And I was actually on the team, German-Russian team, developing an aircraft to run on liquid hydrogen. You might be interested in that.
Oh, really? I would be interested in that. Absolutely. That's a big deal. I know some of the NASA aeronautics guys are working on it. I also want to ask you at some point later in the program, we'll talk to you about hydrogen and fuel in cars.
Yes.
And fuel cells. Art Edwards, let's move on to you. Art, one of the neat things, I love focusing on folks and highlighting folks that I read when they say that they began as a co-op student. Because I think that program is so important to feeding in the future folks that work out here. And I'm just dying for my youngest son, Alex, who is a computer science major, used to have to be a co-op student somewhere. Talk about your beginnings as a co-op student and talk about your experience and your history. You retired recently from United Space Alliance.
Yes, I did. Getting back to the co-op program, I agree. It's a tremendous opportunity for a student. First of all, you get to work in an environment that's akin to what you're taking in school. And secondly, you get paid.
Yeah, nice part of it, right?
That's the best part of it. When I came to Kennedy Space Center in 1967, I was a sophomore.
Okay.
I had just finished my freshman year in college. Didn't know very much about engineering, but I, at that point, I thought I wanted to be one. I was assigned to the CIF antenna site, and at the antenna site was Frank Byrne.
Okay.
And if you know Frank Byrne, he was the brainchild of the Launch Processing System.
Sure, sure.
And at that time, although we were supporting the Apollo program, Frank was designing LPS. He was designing a big portion of LPS.
The Launch Processing System that would eventually power the countdown for the shuttle.
The Launch Processing System that supported all of the shuttle missions.
Right.
He was the brainchild for that. And he allowed us to get somewhat involved in it. Now, again, we were supporting the Apollo program, so that's where our major of us were. But what I learned from that was I learned a lot about engineering. We did a lot of hands-on activities, including snaking cables and getting into antennas and working on servo motors and just all kind of neat stuff. And when I grew up in a very small rural town. All I knew is I wanted to be a fix-it man. And
okay.
I had an aptitude for electronics. I kind of taught myself electronics as I grew up, buying transistor radios, taking them apart, sometimes putting them back together, sometimes not. And that's kind of what I wanted to do. But as my life and career evolved, it moved towards engineering,
right.
Electrical engineering, if you will.
And
so after I went to school and got involved in the co-op program, I got more deeply involved in engineering.
I see when you look at the description of your bio and your history, I see the word safety come up a lot, that you were very involved in some of the safety programs and talk about a little bit about that.
Well, the safety part of my career was towards the end. In fact, the last 13, 14 years I've been involved in safety. And it's a different aspect of what I've done. The first 20, 30 years was more technical, avionics and electrical engineering. But I was the deputy director for Safety, Quality, and Mission Assurance for the United Space Alliance. And the Voluntary Protection Program, VPP,
right.
That was an item that I was responsible for, but did not put a lot of emphasis on it. It required inviting OSHA onto the work site and having them to look at our program. And why would you want to do that? But I went to a conference in Mississippi, in Biloxi, Mississippi. And I had an epiphany at that conference.
Yeah.
It was kind of a life-changing moment. It probably had to do with my son, who was a young engineer at the time. He was having to work with a lot of older guys, and he was having to try and make them work safely, and he was having some challenges. And I realized at that conference that I couldn't really affect his ability to do what he did, but I could certainly affect the lives of a whole lot of other sons and daughters of other people.
Sure.
And so I kind of threw myself into the VPP after that conference. That was 1999. And I think through those efforts, had a lot of good people supporting me. I worked with a lot of good folks in terms of NASA and SGS and other companies. And through those efforts, we changed the culture at Kennedy.
You know, we talk about so much press gets put on the launches and the missions, and it's kind of it's just taken for granted all the work that happens on the ground and all of the stuff that goes into it. The launch processing system included, but the safety thing and the program you're talking about, so much of what Kennedy is all about is what happens, obviously, on the ground and getting these things ready to go. And I know that, again, in being part of the selection committee, this safety work that you did was a huge part of why it was so important to highlight what you did, because that was the key thing. I mean, that was so important to how we got through shuttle so safely and wrapping up the program the way we did. You retired from USA just, what, last year, 2 years
last
ago?
Last year.
Anything up to anything fun today?
Well, I went back in October, and I worked for USA for a bit, and I'm doing some work for Boeing
right now.
In the safety VPP world.
Well, everybody, just like that, believe it or not, we're halfway through the program, but the glass is still half full, because we've got one more gentleman to talk about, Terry Greenfield, who's been around for a long time, too. We're going to pause now for our usual five-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour, get you caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports, especially on this college football Saturday. We'll be back with more from this year's Lifetime Achievement Award winners from the National Space Club Florida Committee in just a few moments. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. This is Space Talk with Jim Behnke.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Phone lines, online inbox open for your questions or comments. The number 321-768-1240, the email address spacetalking@aol.com. If you know one of these three gentlemen and want to put them on the spot, now would be a great time to get back at them. Three guys with us today, Addison Bain, Art Edwards, Terry Greenfield, all three of them going to be Lifetime Achievement Award winners, so the annual award we give out with the National Space Club Florida Committee each year. The luncheon is Tuesday this week in Cocoa Beach. Also at the program on Tuesday, we're going to present our second annual Rising Star Award. It's an award that's targeted for younger achievers who may be fairly early in their career. We want to recognize some up-and-coming folks that have some great promise. This year's Rising Star honoree is a gentleman named Terry Tullis. He's with Nelson Engineering Company and working on safety and design engineering services. And Terry will be recognized, as well as the three veteran folks that we have in the studio with us today. We've already heard somewhat of Addison's and Art's life stories. Terry Greenfield joins us as well. According to the big bio that we have, 1955, he joins us here at the Space Coast. If I look carefully at his resume, Terry, it looks to me like you've worked just about on every single missile and rocket of any import that has launched from here at the Cape. An incredible career.
That's right, Jim. Yeah, kind of like Addison over there, my career began in the Army there. I had gotten too many deferments, and I was getting to be 25 years old, and it was time to do something. They're going to come and get me, because at that time, I was eligible until I was 35 years old.
Okay.
And so I volunteered for the draft, got sent to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and after that, I got sent to Huntsville, Alabama, there at Redstone Arsenal.
Yeah.
And I worked in a fab lab from, September of 55 through January of 56, at which time I had an opportunity to come down to the Cape. And there were several of us came down at the same time. They were looking for it. I worked for Dr. Gruder.
Okay.
Under Dr. Debus there.
Sure.
And I was kind of a cable puller with a guy named Jim Finn there, who worked under Ike Ridgel. And so... You got to know the whole geography there pretty much. So then I became a blockhouse engineer. We took care of doing the test, writing test procedures, performing the tests, and acted kind of like a test conductor for up until the real flight test type stuff
there.
Went through the Jupiter. We trained, had combat training launch area there where we trained the Turkish Army and also the Italian Army there on how to launch a Juno rocket there. It was interesting. We had a 15-minute countdown, and we had explosive-activated batteries.
Sure.
The missile aligned itself, and it was all relay logic. There was absolutely no computers except on board the flight computer.
You pushed a button and things just kind
of
happened.
You did a component test of all the valves.
Right.
And then it went on into the sequence. It had squib activated batteries. You could see the power voltage come up. And it just went on and on and launched. It was, of course, a test launch with no kind of warhead at all. But then I got into the Pershing program. And I was kind of the representative there, really, on the electrical stuff. And that was the first time I got to fire a rocket. I got to fire the first Pershing rocket.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Push the button and
generally
went.
A mechanical guy pushed the button, even though we electrical guys were watching all the stuff that's going on there. But at the same time, we had the old Saturn 1s coming in. And we worked a lot on Saturn 1. And we've got Saturn 1, Saturn 1B, and then Saturn 5. But when we first started working, it was just like working in the private industry. I'd worked at a steel mill after I graduated from Penn State for 2 years. And when I came to work, there was 50 of us there working on Redstones and Jupiters there.
Wow.
It's amazing that we could get all that done with that small group of people. But the countdown was 3 pages long instead of like three volumes. That we have today. And we had no call signs. It was either Terry or Ike or Jim or somebody.
Really?
Yeah, turn, go do your stuff. You know, there was no quality check off or anything like that. That was great, but it got us in trouble after a while because the things got more complicated.
Sure.
We had a blind flange in one time. We were trying to load propellants, and that was on a launch day. And that was very embarrassing. That's when we got into the red tag program. Everything that didn't fly had to have a red tag. Yeah.
There's a lot of talk, about the good old days of, when if you had a problem, you could slap either some putty on it or some duct tape and fly. And again, as you alluded to, it gets more complicated. You do need more checks and balances. But on the other hand, have we gone too far the other way? These newer guys, these commercial guys that say they can come in and do it faster, better, cheaper. Where do you fall on that?
I guess in the old days, I like to use the phrase, we had a passion and ownership.
Yeah.
And people said, that's mine, that whatever system it was. And they treated it as their territory.
Right.
And you didn't need a whole lot of complexity there of the infrastructure. One of the things, though, as we got more complicated, I got more tired of working for the government. And so I stopped. And with another fellow, we built a company here in Rockledge there for Precision Machine Shop. We had a cable shop. We did some commercial stuff related to spinoffs from the NASA stuff we learned about. Then we came back into design. I went from operations to design, and I really enjoyed design because I always liked building things.
Yeah.
And so we kind of stuck in there, and then I graduated from NASA in 1989.
Okay.
Had about 3 or 4 months off and got called back to run a procurement for Boeing on a mass spectrometer. And that started my career again. Okay.
Started all over with a whole new way.
That's right. And so I've been working off and on for all of the engineering support or engineering services contract, as they call them now.
And you retired in what, 2011?
I retired about three times.
Three times.
Yeah.
The most recent one.
I flunked retirement. Yeah.
Well, Terry, let's move over to Addison for a moment, because I want to hear from each of you real quick. Kind of what your favorite moment is. You're talking to folks that say, well, boy, you work at the Cape. Wow, that's really cool. And, say, yeah, I remember this time when. I mean, what's the outstanding memory you have of your time here out here?
I got a couple of short stories I remember during the Apollo program, which was my favorite part of my career, I think.
Yeah. It seems to be everybody's.
But I used to work out of the compressor facility there at 39. It's a facility down on the crawlerway there, about 2 miles from the pad. It's the closest facility. Anyway, that facility, the office, was designed as a hardened facility that in case there was an on-pad explosion of the Saturn V, you'd duck into that office.
Yeah.
Well, we would do it at launch time when the Saturn V took off. We'd sneak out the back of the CCF and watch it.
Oh, gee.
our shirts would front like that from those engines.
I can't even imagine what that'd be like. Wow. I know watching Shuttle, we always try to, I've never saw a Saturn V, and I know a lot of folks like you have seen them, and there's just that one moment in Shuttle, because it gets out of here so quick that you think, well, if it gets any louder or any more powerful, I'm going to have to do something. I'm going to have to hold my ears. And you can see your clothes starting to vibrate. But the idea that a Saturn V taking off, just pounding you moment after moment after moment till that thing clears out of here, something else. All right, what's your favorite story?
Well, I've got a lot of them, but I think my favorite story is over a period of many, many months. I was the lead engineer for avionics for the remote manipulator system.
The Canada arm. The Canada arm. The robot arm.
Right. And we would go and support the design and some of the testing up in Canada. We'd go to Houston, and we developed the software, and we would test the software out.
Sure.
My NASA counterpart, Don Conover, he was a pilot.
Okay.
And he developed a relationship with a lot of the astronauts. In fact, they would fly his plane.
Oh, really?
So I knew a lot of the astronauts personally, but I got to know more through Don. And Don and I, we were real, very good friends.
Yeah.
The Canadians would come down to test. They would come to my house. We'd have the parties. Don played the guitar.
Sure.
And we'd just have a good time. One night we had a fire in the fireplace. It was in the wintertime. And we would just have a real good time. But I remember specifically when we were getting ready to install that first arm, that was just a great interest by the astronauts. They gave us their home phone number, said, call us, you know, when things are happening.
Right.
Don on a Winnebago, he had a big Winnebago, and he would drive his Winnebago out to the Cape, and we would work for a while, and then we would go to sleep for a while.
And go take a nap. Oh, jeez.
But it was very interesting, and probably one of the – now, I've had a lot of highlights, but that was probably one of the highlights because it was a continuing thing, and to see the arm evolved.
Right.
It wasn't fully tested in Earth's atmosphere. And
how could it be?
Well, yeah, how could it be? And we did it right, apparently. They did it right.
Yeah.
And to get it installed and then to watch it on STS-2. Yeah, that was just tremendous.
You know, the robot arm is such an amazing device that enabled so much of our space program. Again, I think it's one of those unsung heroes of our program. It's kind of funny. I had always, you know, covering spacewalks and all this as a reporter, and you watch the arm at work on a two-dimensional TV screen. I never really appreciated what it was doing until I saw the 3D Hubble servicing film out at the visitor complex, and you could see that arm. And I guess I want to say how fragile looking it was, but yet how strong it was and how capable it was. And now the idea that the International Space Station arm can inchworm itself across from place to place like some living little thing on its own, something else. Terry, tell us what's your favorite memory of all those times out there?
Well, like Art, there's many of them there. I know Explorer 1 was certainly great. I was responsible for the balancing and the spinning up of the Sargent rockets.
Oh, really?
Upper staging.
Yeah.
Yeah, all that control system. And that was great. Of course, the Alan Shepard flight, we were involved in that. And I was the second guy to go out after MR-1 had lifted off 4 inches and come back down.
Oh, man.
The mechanics went out and put a regulator in and vented the fuel tank. We sat there for a day.
We're coming on a break. Terry, I keep shortchanging you, and we're going to come back.
Okay.
You know, we could spend a whole hour talking about Mercury Redstone 1 and what happened. What an incredible story out of space history that is. And maybe we'll touch a little bit more on that. We're going to come right back, and when we do, we'll wrap up our conversation of the day. We'll also take a quick weekly look at the local launch forecast. We don't want to shortchange these guys anymore. Great stories to tell. In the meantime, stay tuned. We'll be right back. I'm Jim Behnke. You're listening to Space Talk right here on a Saturday afternoon at WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk with a quick reminder. You can stay in touch with us throughout the week up on Facebook. Just search for Space Talk. On Twitter, look for Space Talking. And for one-stop shopping, visit WMMBAM.com. Keywords Space Talk. Let's take a quick moment now. Look for our weekly look at the launch forecast. The next launch from Cape Canaveral, now targeted for October 4th when the United Launch Alliance Delta IV rocket is to lift off from Complex 37. It'll be carrying the newest GPS navigation satellite into orbit. Launch time set for 8:10 in the morning Eastern Daylight Time again on October 4th. So we got a little ways to wait. We'll hope to see another Falcon 9 and Atlas V launch perhaps also from the Cape in October. Again, September going to be pretty quiet here. In the meantime, the United Launch Alliance team will be busy this week at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California as they attempt to get an Atlas V off the ground on Thursday. It'll be a satellite delivery mission for the National Reconnaissance Office, And we certainly wish our friends at United Launch Alliance well in doing that space shop. For more information about this and all the various launches scheduled around the world, jump on the web to WMMBAM.com. Keyword Space Talk. Look for the link to our launch forecast. And while we're on the calendar, don't forget that the public memorial service for Neil Armstrong will be at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. this Thursday morning at 10 a.m. I know none of us can be there, but the service will be broadcast on NASA TV, so everyone should be able to tune in and watch, whether you're using your cable or satellite service provider or, of course, online at the web, nasa.gov. Today we're talking with Addison Bain, Art Edwards, and Terry Greenfield, the Lifetime Achievement Award winners this week from the National Space Club Florida Committee. Their award luncheon will be on Tuesday. The dinner, of course, the luncheon's sold out. If you're interested in the National Space Club Florida Committee joining, being a part of all this that supports our local space program, in part by honoring these gentlemen who have served us so well, just hop on the web, www.nscfl, that's short for National Space Club Florida, nscfl.org. And as we were saying, going into our last break, Terry, you were talking about some of the stories of the good old days. I'm curious, though, looking where we're at now and in the future, what each of you guys think about where we're at with our space program today? With just a few minutes left for each of you, what do you think about where we're at and where we need to be going?
Well, we're kind of in a holding program, as I see it there. There's a lot of things going on, but there doesn't seem to be a focus on manned spaceflight anymore.
Yeah.
And we're counting really on all of the commercial folks to carry us through to get back into manned spaceflight. And I remember all the time we took on certifying the equipment and training and everything for supporting manned spaceflight. And looking at what is existing today in the commercial world, there's an awful lot more to go to be safe. And I worry about that. I worry about the way we operate in these days with the, you know, in the old days, the program office had like one or two people, and engineering was prime during the development phase.
Sure.
Today, the project offices have thousands of people, if you count JSC and KSC. Mm-hmm. Engineering probably has maybe 400 or 500. And there's you know, unless engineering gets back, moves from the passenger cabin up to the cockpit, I think we're going to keep having trouble there, because there's just not that much experience in the program world these days. Past programs, people migrated from engineering up to the program. Today, they kind of come in from the side and get into the program. So I worry some about the way we're going about things, but we just have to wait and learn.
Very fair. Art, what do you think? Where are we at? Where are we going?
I guess I share a lot of Tara's feelings about some of the concerns about how things are evolving. My experience has been you really have to engineer things. You have to measure twice and cut once. Mm-hmm. And you have to be able to go back and understand when things go wrong. You have to be able to go back and understand why they went wrong. When you fast-track things, sometimes you miss a few things here and there, and you don't capture all the information that's going to be pertinent to understand what went wrong and why it went wrong. That would be my concern. The one of the things that I'm concerned about, and this is in a different vein, is I don't think we promote the benefits of the space program. I don't think that's promoted to the extent that it ought to be. We ought to be able to answer for the average citizen, what's in it for me and why should I care?
Yeah.
And when you look at the technology transfer, when you look at the advancements we've had in technology, it has affected all of our lives. And I think most people don't reflect on that. We're at the point now to where most of the things we have and use on a day-to-day basis, they're just here.
Right.
But the history of those things and how we got those things, the average person does not have a good feel for that. So I think we need to go back and do a little promoting. And at the same time, we need to support the folks that are going to have to take us forward and hopefully help shape the way that they're going to do things. Because if they don't have the traceability, as Terry alluded to, we could get into a situation where, you've got something, but you don't know exactly what you got.
Addison, what do you think?
I kind of agree with the commercial guys getting us into orbit and handing the real tough stuff back over to NASA.
Sure.
That's a good direction. That's the way it should be. And I agree with Art. NASA and I guess our politicians are just done a lax job of getting to the public. The public really need to understand the benefits of the space program. There's a lot of stories about it, but it's just not getting out there.
It's always a fair criticism, and people talk about, well, you know, then sometimes they want to blame public affairs or whatever. I've never seen it as a problem as being, you know, that NASA's not doing enough. I mean, it's doing what it's able to do. But really, so I think what we're talking about in getting the word out to the people is that championing of this program at a national level with our national leaders, that we need more of our congressmen and our senators, and we need a president who, in a way, like Kennedy, we can go back and argue why Kennedy approved the moon program and all that, but he was vocal about it.
Well, he fired
and very
up the
visible
public.
About it.
Yeah, he actually fired up the public. That was good.
And that made all the difference. And we've not had that in any president, Republican or Democrat, ever since. And I think that's a fair thing. I know there's a lot of guys out there right now, and we just about 30 seconds left. All right, let me ask you real quick that say, well, the old timers, that's the way they did it. We need a new way to do things. And so don't be so worried about the commercial space folks. You think they give them a chance to succeed?
I would say give them a chance to succeed. But Terry said something that was pretty profound earlier. And he was talking about ownership. I think when we grew up in space, it was more than a job. It was almost a lifestyle.
Yeah.
And we dedicated ourselves to the success of the programs. And if the commercial guys don't do that, then who knows?
Then we'll see what happens. And, of course, we know some of our friends at SpaceX working long hours, and we'll see how it goes. Addison, Art, Terry, congratulations to all three of you. Thank you so much for this short time you've been able to spend with us on the show today. We could probably do 2 hours with each of you easy, and maybe we will do some sequels with you in the future. We'll see what happens. Have a great lunch on Tuesday. Enjoy it. Don't talk too late. Everybody got to get work back at 1 o'clock. Don't forget. Okay.
Thanks,
guys. Hey, everybody. We're looking ahead to next week. Ed Mango from the Commercial Crew Office at Kennedy Space Center will be our guest to talk about commercial crew. That's it now. Space Talk, a production of Mindless Solutions, brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technologies, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the op station for today's program. Please join us next Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight for another hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMAB presents a weekend edition of the Glenn Beck program. I'm Jim Bankey. We'll talk to you again real soon.